everyone. I'm getting used to my new theme song. I'm Beattie Cohn Bredos, and welcome again, my friends, to the Ask Beattie Show. And for those of you who may be finding me and tuning in to the Ask Beattie Show for the first time, you're probably wondering, what is the Ask Beattie Show all about? And who is Beattie Cohn Bredos? Well, I am a real psychotherapist and a sex therapist. I'm also the author of the book, For Better, For Worse, Forever, Discover the Path to Lasting Love. I am a columnist. I am very outspoken about all kinds of issues that are going on in today's world. I am a national speaker, national radio and television expert guest, and of course, I have been hosting the Ask Beattie Show here on the Progressive Radio Network. It's amazing. It's amazing how the years have gone by for over 6 years. And I have a private practice here in New York City and in East Hampton. And what has been so interesting in the last couple of years, of course, Progressive Radio Network has listeners from all over the world. And I'm finding more and more that people from different countries and different states are emailing me. And of course, this past year has been a Zoom therapy year. In fact, it was just 2 weeks ago that I saw my first live patient, someone who I hadn't seen for over a year. And I have to tell you, I mean, Zoom has worked because we really haven't had any other options, but there is nothing, trust me, there is nothing like being in therapy and being in the same room with your therapist where the therapist is able to really connect with you. I feel on a really different kind of way. There aren't any frozen screens. You're able to really look at people's body language. But again, you know, when we don't have options, we really have to do the best that we can possibly do. So what is my show really all about? Well, it is about empowerment. We talk about all the things that we can do. And of course, do is the key word here to really improve the quality of our lives and the quality of our relationships. And I am not suggesting at all that it is an easy thing to do at all. I mean, we talk about mental health issues and sexuality, and of course, relationships, and how we should be navigating our days in the best possible ways that are actually in our best interest. And in fact, that is the homework that I give every single patient. It's the same homework after every single session, for people to really be mindful as we go through our days. Are we being good to ourselves? Are we, in fact, doing what is in our best interest? And it really causes people to sort of slow down a little bit and be a lot more mindful of potential destructive and self-destructive behavior. And of course, my mantra, and I've been practicing now as a psychotherapist and sex therapist for over 35 years. And every week when I say that, it's like, oh my God, I can hardly believe how really quickly the time is gone, but it's been a privilege. I mean, I've treated thousands of people from every single walk of life and every single socioeconomic group. And I have to tell you, you know, I have learned a great deal of things about human nature and about life. But one of the things that I feel so strongly about is that in order for us, for all of us, whether you're a therapist or just, you know, anybody in life, if we're going to be able to really move forward, and if we have obstacles, and we all have obstacles, and we all have challenges that we have to find ways to get around, we need to be honest with ourselves. And that means acknowledging that there is an issue. I am depressed. I am anxious. I always choose the wrong woman, or I always choose the wrong man. or I am drinking too much, or I am taking too many pills, or I am eating too much food and I am not taking care of my physical being. We need to be honest. I mean, that's really the first step in making any changes at all in our lives. So it is about acknowledging, and of course, acknowledging is really the first step, but that is hardly sufficient. You know, you hear people saying all the time, I need to exercise, I need to eat better, I need to do something about my depression or my sexual abuse or all kinds of issues. And then it stops there. But complaining and acknowledging is not going to resolve the issues or make our life better. The next step, of course, is that we need to find ways to address the things that are getting in the way of our life and our relationships. And sometimes it means talking to a friend. Sometimes it means exercising more and talking with the nutritionist. And there are also times when the very, very best thing that you can do is to find yourself a really good therapist. And I have to underscore that all therapists are not the same. And it is amazing. It is amazing when you take that step, how you can really transform your life. And I think these days, mental health happens to be everywhere. People are talking about it on television and the radio, in the newspapers, and it's all a really, really good thing. We no longer have to live in the closet, so to speak, with our depression and our anxiety and our other psychiatric problems. Because if you're looking, for example, at depression, 17 million adults in the United States suffer from clinical depression, and that translates into 7.1% of adults, and for women, 8.7%. And females experience, and I always say when I read this, we express depression at roughly 2 times the rate for men, although you may be very interested in knowing that the highest suicide rate is for single older men. So hopefully what is going on in our society right now is giving us all permission to be able to express our fears and our anger and our worries and our issues that probably stem from our own family of origins, and to finally be able to actually take steps to do something about all of this, even though, of course, we cannot change our history. If you're talking about anxiety disorders, 40 million Americans are suffering from a variety of different anxiety disorders. And if you're looking also at suicide, that suicide happens to be the 10th leading cause of death in the United States for all ages. And this is a really disturbing statistic, that suicide is the second leading cause of death in the world for those ages 15 to 24. So our kids, our youth, they are really, really very, very much at risk. And hopefully the schools are doing a much, much better job in having counselors so that the students are going to be able to access really good mental health care when their depression is worsening and they are at a place in their lives where they're actually contemplating suicide. You know, people ask me all the time, what is going on in my practice here in New York City and also in East Hampton? Well, the theme of the practice these days happens to be women who are in very untenable situations and are in very destructive and self-destructive kinds of relationships. I want to give you some very disturbing statistics before I share some really good news with you about what we need to do so that we are never going to make a mistake in love again. Statistic number one. Every day, 4 women die in the United States as a result of domestic violence. And every year, approximately 132,000 women report that they have been victims of rape or attempted rape, and more than half of them knew their attackers. And every year, 1.2 million women are forcibly raped by their current or former male partner. And what is going on in the college world? Well, 30% of college students report dating abuse. The divorce rate for first marriages is 48%. The divorce rate for second marriages is 67%. And the divorce rate for third marriages is 73%. So what exactly is going on? And of course, much more importantly, what should we be doing about this? Because despite all of the relationship books and the relationship therapists and the relationship podcasts, we are continuing to spiral downwards when it comes to finding and maintaining healthy relationships. So why is this happening? And really and truly, the question, of course, is if you are someone who has had a history, and maybe your current situation is one where you are in a destructive or self-destructive or abusive kind of relationship, again, are you willing to actually acknowledge, address, and resolve the problems within yourself? Because I hear this all the time. Well, he is a narcissist. Of course, she could be a narcissist as well. And what do I do? What do I do to get this narcissist to love me? But that is the wrong question. What is the right question? The right question is, what is it? What is it about me that I have recognized that I am with a narcissist, somebody who has nothing to give me at all other than a lot of angst and disrespect and worry and pain? So the real question is, what is it about me that is wanting to remain in a relationship with someone who has basically nothing to give me at all that's any good? Now, I have people say to me, well, you know, he has some money and we can go to fancy parties and on occasion we really have a good time. But again, you have to ask yourself, is that the kind of a life? Is that the kind of relationship that you want, that you are willing to stay in, where you are continually being disrespected, humiliated, and for so many women, abused as well, emotionally and physically and verbally and sexually? So it's kind of on you. It's kind of on us to figure out why it is that these are the kinds of relationships that we attract. And of course, you know, usually it is a result of growing up in an environment where either you were emotionally, physically, sexually abused, where abuse becomes something that is very, very much tolerated, that feels normal. It feels right because those are the situations that you have become used to for so many years growing up as a child. But my feeling is this. Look, we are unable to change history. We can't change anything that's happened even 30 seconds ago. So the question then becomes, what are you willing to do to change that trajectory so that you are finally going to be in a place where you have real clarity? You have real clarity about yourself. You've worked through as best as you can the old issues that get in the way of your life and your relationships. You are dealing as best as you can with the depression and the anxiety and the fears and worries of just being a human being. So again, it's really on you. I mean, we look to others to save us. And, you know, these days I hear from so many women, well, I wanted the happily ever after story. Well, we all want the happily ever after story, but it is just not going to happen because we are wishing it or we are wanting it. So look, everybody, there are four things. There are four things that we all need to do so that we are never going to make a mistake in love again. And if you have a piece of paper and if you have a pen handy, or if you're going to listen to the rebroadcast of the Ask Beauty Show, which of course is rebroadcast on the Progressive Radio Network in the archives, this is something that I am really hoping that you are going to take in. So number one, if each of us is not in a good place emotionally and psychologically, it is not going to be possible, regardless of our wishing and wanting and hoping and dreaming, to have a healthy long-term relationship with anyone. So again, the question then becomes, what are you going to do? What are you going to do about your old unfinished business, your old issues, the old abuse, the old depression, the new depression, the old anxiety, the new anxiety? Are you willing? And this is one thing that I ask potential patients all the time. I need for people to be serious. Otherwise, I'm going to waste my time. They're going to waste their money and their time. And we are going to absolutely go around in circles. So that's really the primary question that you and then each of us has to be serious about and really ask ourselves. Are we willing? Are you absolutely willing to do some work? And it is not fun, but the fact is that to be able to finally, once and for all, you know, emotionally work through what did and didn't happen that got you to a place in your life, if we're talking about relationships where you are continually engaging in destructive and self-destructive relationships, you are going to be amazed how this kind of work is definitely going to change your life for the better. So there is not another day to waste on this. So that again, if you are wanting a good relationship, the first thing you are going to have to do, and yes, of course you can go on match.com and all the dating sites and you can be looking, you know, for men and you can be looking for women, but this is the first order of business. Number one. Okay, number two, what else do we all have to do? Well, we all have a responsibility to ourselves to really learn the ingredients to go into a healthy long-term relationship. You know, like one of my patients yesterday was saying to me, she said, well, my boyfriend has had a chronic illness and he screams and he yells and he disrespects me in front of people, but maybe it is because of his illness and I should be understanding of all of the humiliation and insults that he hurls at me. Now, obviously this woman, you know, it's nice that she's very concerned that her boyfriend has a chronic problem, but it is not okay. It is absolutely not okay, chronic problem or not, that he continues to hurt her and humiliate her and disrespect her. So as we were talking yesterday, in this particular situation, it all goes back to her own family of origin, where she was hurt and humiliated and disrespected and put down. And after all these years, on some unconscious level, this wonderful woman still feels that this is okay. And she was told by her parents that she was not much. She was not much as a child and that she was not going to go anywhere as an adult and that she should be grateful for any man at all that would want to be with her. So you can imagine the kind of trauma that this woman has sustained throughout her life, and we are still working on it. So no, it's unfortunate that her boyfriend has a chronic problem, but it is never okay to be abused or humiliated or disrespected under any circumstances at all. And, you know, another patient of mine who's actually a number of years younger than this woman. This woman is in her 30s, was making excuses, continually making excuses for her husband's cheating on her with other women. And when we talk about this, and what was really interesting is that it was a bit of a secret when she was growing up as a child, but she discovered later on when she was a young adult that her father cheated on her mother for most of the marriage. So even though it was never really talked about in the family, somehow, again, on some deep unconscious level, this woman learned that it was okay. I suppose if daddy did it to mom and I love daddy, that maybe it is okay that my current husband is cheating on me as well. So, you know, needless to say, we're not going to be able to change anybody. We're not ever going to be able to change our partners. The very best that we are going to be able to do is to make some changes, within ourselves. So again, number two, to be very, very clear about what ingredients actually go into a healthy long-term relationship or a marriage. And when things start to go awry, it's not about sucking it up and making excuses for somebody's bad behavior. It's stopping people in their steps, yes, carefully and sensitively, and being able to say to somebody, "Don't you talk to me like this." One of the women who we had this very same conversation with, she said to me, "If I said something like this to my boyfriend, he would tell me to leave." And I said to her, "He would be giving you a gift because you do not want to be in a relationship with somebody who's going to continue to abuse you, whether it's emotionally or physically or sexually." But, you know, the thing is that we need to do a much, much better job in educating ourselves about healthy relationships. I mean, that's just a fact. And the thing that is so interesting is because, you know, mental health, and we're talking about relationships all the time, is out there in a way that has never happened before, where you're seeing, you know, talk therapy commercials on television and online, but somehow we continue to miss the boat. So number one, we need to be okay. Number two, we need to have clarity about the ingredients that go into a successful relationship. And then, of course, number three is my book and my 10-step formula that teaches you exactly. It's like having me in your purse or in your wallet, teaching you how to assess who's right for you and who's wrong for you before committing to any serious relationship. And for those of you who've been listening to the Ask Beattie Show for the last number of years, you've probably heard this story before, is that before I did my research and did the book For Better, For Worse, Forever, Discover the Path to Lasting Love, and it is a book that I wish I had had when I was starting out in my own dating and relationship life. I would meet people and I would say, "I met this really nice woman," or "I met this really, really lovely man, and they're so trustworthy and they're so nice." And of course, you know, what I've learned over the years is that, you know, one has to be very foolish to make that kind of a comment, and that the very, very, very best that you could say is that you've met somebody who appears, and that's the word, appears to be lovely and trustworthy and wonderful and great. And, you know, I apologize for the results of my research, because in my private life, I'm such an impatient person. But my research really found that it takes about a year to find out who somebody is and to find out who somebody is not. And you really cannot fast forward that process. Now, obviously, if you're going to be experiencing a lot of red flags, abuse of various different kinds, or including, you know, substance abuse, you're not going to stay in, you know, just because the research talks about that it takes about a year to find out who somebody is and is not. But, you know, these are things that we have to be willing to take some real personal responsibility. And, you know, mostly, you know, I'll hear, how is it that I always end up in these horrible relationships? Or, you know, what is it about me? Or what is it about the men? But there's a real learning curve here. And this relationship education, I mean, for me, I think it is one of the most important subjects, if not the most important subject, that we should, you know, be teaching our children in, you know, in schools, because the reality is that we research everything. We research cars and computers and real estate and grams of fat. And, you know, you think back how often you thought you knew everything there was to know about your partner. And you may have believed that this person who you were in love with was exactly who he or she seemed to be. And then you were sure you'd found. We all want to find our life partner and perfect match. And then suddenly, you know, without warning, you happen to realize that you are headed for disaster. Your relationship is in shambles. Your mind is spinning. What went wrong? The chances are that the signs were there all along and you just didn't know what to look for. But you have, you know, you have the capability, you have the smarts to be able to educate yourself in ways so that you are really never going to make a mistake in love again. So, you know, the real question is, you know, are you on board, or are you going to continue to do the same things over and over and over again and expect a different result? So I'm hoping that your answer is no. And I'm hoping that I have convinced you that it is a good thing to educate and to empower yourself, and above all, to keep yourself safe. Well, we're going to have a little change in subject, and we are going to be talking, I don't know how many of you follow tennis, and I don't know how many of you were aware or are aware that I was actually number 10 in Canada as a junior tennis player. I competed all my life. I'm still playing a lot of tennis, and we are going to be looking at what has happened with Naomi Osaka. And before I introduce my guest, I just want to give you a little bit of an update about what's happened. That last week, a woman, ambitious Naomi Osaka, great player, to become the world's second ranked women's tennis player at 23, she chose to prioritize her personal well-being about the opportunity to play in one of her sport's most critical tournaments. And this, of course, is the French Open. Naomi Osaka announced that she would withdraw from the French Open just days after tennis officials fined her $15,000 and threatened to oust her from the tournament for opting out of its mandatory news conference. For those of you who may not know, after the matches, the players are expected to be interviewed, and many of the questions are just so repetitive and so boring. And the players, they've just finished a tough match. But in any case, that has been the protocol. So what happened was, Naomi Osaka, she explained that speaking to the international media, that it takes a heavy toll on her mental health, compounding the anxiety inherent to Grand Slam tournaments. And what ended up happening, she decided that she was going to withdraw from the tournament, expressing to the world, really, that self-care was the priority for her. And of course, there was a real outcry, and a lot of people felt that this was something that she should not have done. But with my guest today, which is my husband, Jim Bredos, the love of my life, who is a sociologist who keeps me up to speed in really looking at a more gestalt way of examining the world and issues. And he is also the host of really an amazing show, The Radical Imagination on MNN. And you can see it in all the boroughs in New York. It's a great show. You should tune in. It airs multiple times during, I think, every day and, of course, every week. So thank you for joining me. And we need to talk about protocol, and we need to talk about rules, and we need to talk about a lot of different things that I feel have really never been brought out, Jim, in the way that they are being brought out today.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much for having me here again, Petey. And you certainly keep me on my toes every day as well. So
that's a good thing, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And tennis players and a lot of athletes have to keep on their toes too, right? And so, gosh, where do you want to start on this? There's so much to talk about.
Well, do you remember, and I was actually surprised at my own reaction, when I heard that Naomi withdrew, what was my comment to you? I said, look, she gets millions of dollars in endorsements, and what could be so difficult about having a 3 or 4 minute post-match interview? And your response to me really got me to think about my own initial reaction.
Well, again, as you've just said, you are the tennis player, and you have been for most of your life, and you have been in tournaments, and you're very well aware of the protocols and the traditions and the norms of a wonderful, wonderful sport. I played, I never got into any tournaments and so on. And of course, there are always rules and regulations and norms, but you're right. This is really something new that we're all facing here. I can't imagine that a Steffi Graf or...
it wouldn't have happened.
Yeah, it wouldn't have happened 10, 15, 20 years ago. This is a new generation. She's 23 years old, and she resonates around the world on so many levels. So I think we can approach this in so many different ways. She obviously is a very sensitive person. She's a great tennis player. And
she's struggling, but she is struggling with depression and anxiety and had, when I think about my initial comments, of course, it's really important to rethink your attitudes and beliefs, because when I was growing up, we had to wear whites.
That's right.
I remember one time, Jim, and I'll never forget this, at the Winnipeg Tennis Club. And here I was, Manitoba champion for years and years in different age groups. I threw my racket.
Oh my goodness.
I had come back from the Nationals, and I saw some of the top players who were older than me. They were throwing their rackets, and I thought it was really cool.
Now, you didn't yell like John McEnroe.
No, I didn't yell, but I remember. I can still see it. Yeah. I threw my racket, and the president of the Winnipeg Tennis Club came up to me and said, "Beattie, young lady, if I ever see you do that again, you will not be permitted to play at this club." And that was it. I never threw my racket again.
What do you think he would do if he was still around now? Well, how do you think he would respond now? I know this is impossible question answer, but it's within the historical context.
I think, Jim, and I think this is where maybe you and I, we sometimes differ. I think that some protocol happens to be appropriate and needed and necessary, and the kind of language and the kind of behavior that we have seen on and off the courts, the basketball courts, the tennis courts, it never would have been tolerated when I was growing up and competing in a variety of different sports provincially and nationally. It would not have been allowed. We were expected to behave in the Canadian, you know, kind and gentle and nice sort of a fashion.
Power arrangements had been established for a long time, and the players were expected to follow that.
But we didn't question it.
I know. Well, now that's the whole point. Now we are at a lot of different levels. What is the purpose of these interviews? How are we using, perhaps even exploiting these players for profit? And the whole question of our...
You say exploiting these players. I mean, that again, I'm going to take a differing view here. These players, particularly the top players, I mean, they are winning millions and millions and millions of dollars and endorsements.
Yeah, but look at the corporate sponsorship of these tournaments. They're gigantic on all the sports. Every stadium, every arena is named after some sort of bank or some sort of company and corporation and so on and so on. So the owners are some are multi-billionaires. We're dealing with huge amounts of money. The media is making huge amounts of money. Yes, I'm certainly.
And the top players are making huge amounts of money.
Not necessarily most of them, but yes, absolutely. And they pay a price for that. And not just in the tennis world, in the business world, in the celebrity world, in the political world. We have so many different stories coming out of bad behavior, of all kinds of things happening between people. And I think we're exploring the reasons for this perhaps at a deeper level now than we've ever had before. And I think it's great.
No, I think it's great that, you know, mental health, you can hardly turn on a show any longer. I mean, you have in treatment. I mean, there's just so many therapy shows and shows dealing with therapy and putting mental health issues out there, which as a therapist, I mean, I think it's a really, really, you know, important thing.
Well, if I just say very briefly, I am very pro-therapy. I have had a wonderful, wonderful experience for several years with a wonderful therapist. But I also, as a sociologist, need to say, and you've given us the facts and the data, when you're talking about so many people, hundreds of thousands and millions of people, I think what we need to do is start talking about mental health and mental illness beyond simply just individuals as public health issues, as social structural issues that are embedded in our economy, in our social structure, in our relationships with each other. So it goes beyond individuals. I'm not saying individuals need to be seen as individuals, but we're talking about now something that goes transcends individuals.
Which, of course, you know, leads me to quote a piece that you gave me this morning in the New York Times. And this really emphasizes exactly what you are saying. It says that in a society that prizes individual achievement above most other things, ambition is often framed as an ambiguous virtue akin to hard work or tenacity. But the pursuit of power and influence is to some extent a vote of confidence in the same profit-driven myth of many of the problems that have betrayed millions of Americans and American women through the course of the pandemic and before it, to our disillusionment and despair.
Not just in the sports world, in the everyday.
Right.
Well, and I think we should also realize, too, you can look at other sports. The obsessiveness, I mean, the extreme extent to which we push, and that's measured in terms of rates of concussions, for example, that football players go through, and it starts at such an early age with young footballers experiencing that as well. So we've got to realize, as we push people, the consequences of doing that. These young kids are taught at such an early age, just suck it up and just, you know, do what you need to do and pay, play through the pain and so on. And I'm not saying, look, I did as you do. We were athletes, and I'm not saying that that's you do that to a certain extent, but the extreme, I think what we're talking now is the extreme, and I think it's manifesting itself, as you point out, in this data, in the statistics.
Well, I think it's going to be interesting to see, you know, really what the upshot is in the world of tennis and in other sports. Now that Naomi Osaka has had the real courage to say, I can't do this. I am feeling too depressed. I am feeling
too anxious. You mean in terms of the reactions?
Yes. What's going to happen?
By the administration and the people running these tournaments. What do you think?
It's a very good question. And I mean, I happen to believe that Naomi Osaka is definitely, you know, struggling with these sorts of issues. But then what happens, Jim, if somebody has had a bad match, let's just say, and they've decided that they are too upset and they don't want to really fulfill the terms of their contract? And this is where the managers come into it, where they have agreed. There's a contract that stipulates that there's certain expectations that the players are expected to fulfill. And it has always been, you know, having the post-match interviews.
Now that's thrown into question.
Right.
These are not, as I understand, it's not the Ten Commandments here. It's not etched in stone.
Right.
And things, times have changed. People are changing. People's interests and concerns are changing. So why not? Why not have a look again at these sorts of things?
Right.
And let's talk together and figure this out.
No, it's true. In fact, it was an interesting letter to the editor also in the New York Times. And this man says that it is high time for both the organizers of celebrity events and the press to rethink post-match, post-game, and red carpet frenzies. And if the subject of a press grilling does not want to do it, back off and no penalties for the subject. Celebrities of all kinds are entitled to their privacy, even if it means the media misses the scoop. So, you know, Naomi Osaka, she's really spoken out. She's really, really made a point about putting mental health, certainly in the tennis world, and not just in the tennis world.
Making these interviews a little more interesting. They're boring as hell, and they're rolling their eyes.
Exactly.
You know what this, I mean, not totally, but, you know, let's do it. And why is it etched in stone that it needs to happen on the court there? I mean, it could be done in the clubhouse or in the private room or something with one or two of the sportscasters. So all of this needs to be reexamined. I think we'll come up hopefully with a more humane, rational way of dealing with each other.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. You know, when I think of dress and how we were expected to wear only white when I was competing and I was a child, growing up, I mean, you look at what's happened with even clothing.
Even the Wimbledon, now are they still wearing white?
I believe so.
I think so.
Yes, I think that's the last tournament.
Maybe.
So now people are, you know, saying, hey, I'm going to be who I am and I'm going to wear exactly what I want to wear. And I think that has not been an issue.
The clothing in
many, many years, so that there have been, you know.
Why don't you think that it has been?
That's a really, really good question.
Well, because maybe the clothing industry has come in. And,
true.
Is what the kids want. Why not? And let's use it. Different sneakers, different this. And I mean, some of the, it's interesting. It's fun. Now, what will be interesting is see if she, in fact, will go to Wimbledon. I think she's, Osaka's canceled the next tournament. Right?
Yes, that'll be
very interesting. And, we'll have to see. We'll have to wait and see. But I hope people will get smarter and more sensitive and listen to what she has to say, because it is important and what people are feeling. And you know, there's got to be a give and take, a much better give and take that occurred than that did occur in the French Open.
No, it's really true. And If there are changes that are going to happen in all kinds of ways, as your guest, Fran Piven, on your television show mentioned a couple of weeks ago, that there needs to be a lot of noise. And for people, you know, who are feeling really strongly about issues, I suppose this is where the social movements and this is where the protesting really comes into play, where we have to be willing to speak out and really take on the establishment. And again, in the world of tennis, I can't even believe that this was something that I just accepted over the years. When I had a sports therapy show and I was interviewing Arthur Ashe, I never thought about that, gee, he would not be willing to have an interview with me because he just came off the court.
Well, do you remember what sort of questions you asked?
Well, with Arthur Ashe, it was interesting because when I was a kid, I had danced with him at a dance in Winnipeg, and I was much more interested in talking about that and seeing whether or not he had remembered me, which he which he had. Right. So it was not about his game. It was more about him. And then, of course,
not only that, as a black tennis player in those days, this is what went. Mid-70s, early 80s, you're talking about.
He was playing in the 80s. And when I saw him actually at the US Open and did the final interview before he actually came out and announced to the world that he had AIDS, it was in, I believe, 1992.
Right. So that took a lot of courage too. So little by little, these different issues come out, and over a period of time, the so-called establishment has to deal with it. And it gets interesting as things get more and more politicized. I wonder, Osaka, of course, has taken a major stand in support of Black Lives Matter.
She has.
I wonder if somehow the response by the French establishment, the tennis authorities there, reflected a little bit some of her stand on that. I have no idea, but I wouldn't be surprised that it was a little bit of a payback, perhaps.
Well, that has been questioned. In fact, there was another article that you gave me, and this was a transcript Amy Goodman's television show. Really questioning. In fact, the woman who was interviewed on Amy's show wondered whether or not that Black women athletes are often subjective to insensitive questioning from the media that can perpetuate racist and sexist narratives, and the media is overwhelmingly white, overwhelmingly older, and overwhelmingly male.
All right, so Beanie, what do you make of that? Because I know you're a true warrior on the court there, and you are gutsy, and boy, you're tenacious, and irregardless of race, color, creed, religion, age, you're a warrior out there. But now, what is that article more or less saying too? That we need to take into consideration variables that we may have never really considered before.
Well, I mean, this woman, her last name is Davis. I mean, what she's basically suggesting is that that racism was a factor in why the establishment at Roland Garros at the French Open took the stance of fining her $15,000 for not wanting to do her post-match interview. But they would have fined anybody $15,000, whether or not she was Black or Haitian or Jamaican or white or Jewish or Christian. I mean, when I read this article that you gave me this morning, I paused and I said, "This doesn't quite resonate with me." A contract was signed. The players have certain contractual agreements of what they're supposed to do and not supposed to do in return for playing and for, making great money if they happen to win. So I was very taken aback to read that this person, Amari Rose Davis, an assistant professor of history and women's gender and sexuality studies at Penn State, and co-host of the sports podcast, Burn It All Down, started to bring in race as an issue when I certainly don't see that at all.
Well, but let me just broaden the question. you're not necessarily denying that race and religion, to a lesser extent, you were a Jewish tennis player. I mean,
and one of the only Jewish tennis players in Canada at the time, right?
Overt anti-Semitism, but there was sort of subtle things. But
no, I never got invited to anybody's birthday party.
Well,
it's true though.
You're not denying the fact that tennis and all sports involve issues of race and gender and homophobia and transphobia and class and so on. It plays a part.
But it may play a part at some level. But this was, I think it's
not
really,
in this specific case, right?
I think it's really a mistake to broaden everything out when you're looking at one issue. The issue was for players who had contractual agreements that they were going to do post-match interviews.
Right.
And if they did not do it, there was going to be a $15,000 fine, whether you were gay or straight or black or white or Haitian or Jamaican.
Right, we talked about that there probably needs to be some sort of modification.
Right,
okay, so
right.
Let's leave that alone
right.
for now. The initial complaint or the initial statement by her was that for the past 3 years, she has felt this sense of depression.
Since the Serena match in 2018. And that was the fiasco, what happened with the Serena match. And with the umpire and Serena's, upset, whether it was justified, not justified. I'm not making, any values because I love Serena.
Right.
But apparently that tournament, according to Naomi Osaka, triggered her depression and anxiety, or so she said.
As a therapist, so what do you think got triggered? Now, here's a young woman. She's, 20 years old?
It was a terrible experience for Naomi Osaka.
Very naive, sheltered, we could say, naive in a certain sense. Very, very shy.
The behavior was disgusting, what went on. I understand that Serena was really upset and she had some issues with the umpire and maybe he didn't make some really great calls, but that event, I mean, this was her first major final. That event, and we were watching it, Jim,
yes.
it freaked me out. I mean, it was so upsetting. It was so over the top. And Naomi, she just stood there.
But you're asking the right question. It's still not all that clear. What role does race play? It's easy to throw out these terms. Well, that's racist. This is such. And what does one mean by that? And what are the nuances about this? She is Japanese. She's Haitian. She is a big supporter of Black Lives Matter. Tennis traditionally has been a pretty privileged sport, right?
But that's true. But we have to be able
white,
to differ. True, absolutely,
okay.
Absolutely true. But we have to look at this specific incident,
right,
and this specific issue.
Got it.
And maybe talk to Coco Gauff and maybe talk to some of the other Black players.
Absolutely.
And see what their experience is on the tour. I mean, these are some of the greatest players ever.
Absolutely. But they, they may be reluctant to talk themselves.
I think Coco Gauff, who is a, just up and coming, amazing, amazing woman.
Vulnerable to the system. I mean, Serena is the senior one that has the resources and the gravitas and the seriousness that could take that chance. I understand what you're saying. And I think that's the really interesting question, the appropriate question. What are some of the other Black female tennis stars think about this?
Well, I know that everybody, or almost everybody, have expressed a lot of compassion, toward Naomi. And I really hope, in fact, she's someone I would absolutely, get to know. I would love to treat her. And I understand exactly what she is saying. But for me, Jim, in this particular situation, unless there are things that we don't know, it was a question of breach of contract. And that is what, now, does this whole issue need to be, revisited? Absolutely so. Absolutely.
No, I agree with you. That's the only thing I was saying before, that the only possible, I shouldn't say the only possible, but her alliance with the Black Lives Matter movement, her, I don't know if she's still going with this rap singer.
Not sure.
And what she represents is this young, up-and-coming,
activist,
powerful force.
Yeah. Activist, which is great.
And what the more traditionalists are threatened by.
I think you're right. And I think they may be threatened. You hear a lot of people saying, you know, not what are we just talking about? Black Lives Matter, that all lives should matter. So I'm sure that is a part of what a lot of people may be feeling.
I do want to say that, you know, we all have our problems in all the countries. France has its own monumental issues in terms of race as well.
Right. Right.
Islamophobic, anti-Semitism. So they're dealing with some stuff there too, in a very rigid, class-oriented society as well. So we just throw that in. That's not to put a blame on any of the French.
Right.
It'll be interesting how the Brits handle this.
But it was a breach of contract. Now, the other thing that and I'm talking about relationships and what we enable and what we engage in and what we agree to, whether or not it's in our personal relationships, our business relationships, our sports relationships. I mean, the players, when they are signing their new contracts, where this would be an issue and this would be a clause in the contract.
I said, this is not the Ten Commandments. And, you know, contracts have been torn up.
Then don't agree to the contract.
Well,
don't agree to the clause. Don't say yes when you mean no.
Well, I think, as again, we've just said, I think a lot of these so-called protocols and rules and regulations and norms need to be looked at again. I'm not saying
agreed
that they need to all get thrown out. I'm not saying that at all. There's certainly got to be decorum and so on.
I just hope that Naomi is going to get some really good treatment. And
I agree, and I want to see her play.
I want to see her play. Yes, I want to definitely see her play in Wimbledon too. And I'm just getting this message that there's just 2 minutes left from the show.
You know,
well, you know, have we solved the problems of the world? I think that, you know, what you're saying and what I'm saying is that everything these days really needs to be looked at. And just because we have a history of a certain kind of protocol or a certain kind of contract, and I think that is what's happening these days, is that virtually everything is being looked at. And I think that that's a really good thing. So thank you.
And
thank you.
It's scary for people too.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, listen, thanks again for the wonderful interchange able to have it with you every single day. Well, listen, everybody, another hour has come and gone here on the Ask Beatty Show. And I want to thank you all so much for listening and for emailing and for tuning in and for your comments. And I leave you with my same weekly message, which I hope you're really going to take in. And of course, the first message, the first bit of homework, is to do everything that you can possibly do to love yourself and to really do what is in your best interest and not say yes when you mean no, and be careful who we let into our lives. And of course, the second message is that we all need to do a much, 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 you know, better job in learning to tolerate and in learning to really love each other. So thanks again for listening. And I will be with you next week and every other week here on the Ask Beatty Show, right here on the Progressive Radio Network. So have a good, good rest of the day. And we will talk soon. And listen, I really appreciate your comments. We don't always have to agree. Debate and conversation is a really, really important thing to have, whether or not it's with me, your partners, your family, your friends. It's all good. So take good care and goodbye, everybody.